Hello, my friend. Welcome back to another episode of Creative Elements, my last re-air before I'm back from my honeymoon. Thanks for hanging with me. Today, I'm re-airing my conversation with Matt Diavella. This episode originally aired as episode number 21, all the way back on August 18th, 2020. I'm re-airing this episode because Matt is an OG creator. You may know him from his YouTube channel, which today has more than 3.3 million subscribers, or you may know him as the director of Minimalism, the hit documentary on Netflix. You may even know him for his podcast, The Ground Up Show, which he no longer creates, but is still serving as content inspiration for video podcasters all over the world. I was just listening to an episode of Colin and Samir, and they said that they hired one of Matt's old video podcast editors to work with them on their video podcast. It still ripples through the industry today. So if you enjoy this episode, tweet at Matt Diavella. He's Matt Diavella on Twitter. Let him know that you enjoyed it. I would love to have him back for a round two. And we'll get to that full episode right after this.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
And I read everything you could on entrepreneurship and building and growing an audience. And I'm like, I know all the things. I need to actually put it into action now and just give myself 2 to 3 years and say, okay, I'm just going to dedicate myself for this period of time, no matter what.
Welcome to Creative Elements, a show where we talk to your favorite creators and learn what it takes to make a living from your art and creativity. I'm your host, Jay Klaus. Let's start the show. Hello, my friend. It's great to have you back here today on Creative Elements. This is a fantastic episode and an incredible guest that I cannot wait to share with you. But first, I have to tell you a story. Last summer, the summer of 2019, I produced a full-length documentary. Now, a year later, that sounds like such a bizarre thing that I can't believe I'm saying, and it feels like it was a lifetime ago, but I did it. That documentary really came out of my other podcast called Upside, which studies startup communities across the country. It's called Test City USA, and it's a film about the startup community here in Columbus, Ohio.
Columbus, Ohio, Test City USA. For the past 2 decades, American business has tested more of its products in Columbus than in any other major American community. For through the years, industry has discovered that what happens in Columbus today will be happening all over America tomorrow.
Through a bunch of lucky breaks, we were able to work with an Ohio State University student athlete over the summer named Kyle Skinner, who wanted to be a filmmaker. So we put him to work directing a film for us over the summer. And long story short, we filmed, edited, and even aired this documentary in September 2019 at a film festival here in Columbus, Ohio. It's 94 minutes long, it won an award, and it was one of the most difficult, fun, and fulfilling creative projects I've ever made. And that's after more than a year of podcasting and several years of writing. Now, you may be thinking, all right, Jay, what's the point of all of this? Well, today I'm talking with Matt Diavella. Matt directed, filmed, and edited a full-length documentary once himself. And if you haven't seen it, I'll bet you've heard of it.
I teamed up with a couple bloggers that I had met named Josh and Ryan, who ran a website called The Minimalists. And we decided to just hit the road and just get started, interview as many people as we could that were experiencing the benefits of this thing called minimalism. And so that was really, when I think back to it, the first original piece of content that I created.
Not bad for the first original piece of content that he created. That film was called Minimalism, a documentary about the important things, and it was acquired by Netflix in 2016. And I'll be honest, it was a lot more successful than Test City USA was.
It went trending on Netflix, number one on iTunes. You know, obviously Netflix doesn't give the numbers away, but apparently it looked like millions of people were watching this film, and we just heard from people all over the world. It blew all of our expectations away. That's to put it lightly, because it was a one-person crew. It was largely myself shooting and editing, I would say 99% of this thing. I got some friends to help, and I was lucky to have some really great friend color grade it and do the sound mix on it. But other than that, it was my responsibility to bring this thing to life. And so, you know, I think a lot of people have this expectation when they see something, maybe that looks polished and that looks like that reaches a platform like Netflix, like, oh, there was 300 people working on this thing and it was this whole elaborate production. And like, no, it was just me in my bedroom, you know, clacking away at my keys and putting in 12 hours a day, eating nothing but peanut butter sandwiches and drinking coffee every day.
That documentary helped to put both the minimalists, Joshua Fields Milburn and Ryan Nicodemus, on the map, and it kicked off Matt's career as an independent creator as well. Matt Diavella has a minimalist website and a minimalist personal bio on that website. He calls himself a filmmaker, YouTuber, and podcaster that explores what it means to live a good life. He started making videos for YouTube after completing the documentary, and his YouTube channel now has nearly 3 million subscribers with videos that have been viewed more than 175 million times. You may remember an audio clip from one of his videos in episode 9 with Jason Zook. In this episode, we talk about his experience creating the minimalism documentary, managing his creative energy, crafting a good story, and how experimentation has helped him find success on YouTube. I'd love to hear your thoughts on this episode as you listen. You can put them in our Creative Elements listeners group on Facebook, where I'll also be sharing some of my favorite videos from Matt's channel throughout the week. And of course, you can find me on Twitter or Instagram at Jay Klaus. I'd love to hear from you. But now, let's hear from Matt.
I think when I look back, it was a little bit of a sloppy road to get into creating my own original content. I know that it was something I always wanted to do. I was always the person trying to start the blog and then wouldn't make a post for 3 months and then come back and say, oh my God, I'm so sorry that I haven't like posted in a while, even though my mom was the only one that actually read my blogs at the time. I was always a fan. I always like enjoyed reading blogs. I wasn't as much into YouTube videos, but just like the original content creation game, I was just always a fan of it ever since like 2010, even a little bit earlier. But to really make a living, to pay off $100,000 in student loan debt, I really poured myself into my freelance filmmaking career. And that's really where I invested all my time, energy, and resources in the beginning. It's kind of hard not to when you have to make ends meet. I think I was also lucky in the fact that I really loved filmmaking. I love the craft of it. I love freelancing. And so I worked on some really not so glamorous jobs and projects like every freelancer has to. So the weddings, bar mitzvahs, local television commercials. And that's where I got my chops and I got a lot better. And then eventually I got to this point where I was ready to take a risk. And I had at the time paid off a majority of my debt, I think maybe like 60, 70% of it. And so I was feeling more confident, like I was ready to take a risk. I'm definitely risk averse and I'm definitely very conservative when it comes to taking those risks. And so I like to make sure that I'm really ready for it. But once I do make that leap, I just go all in. And so for me, that meant making my first feature length documentary. It was probably a 2-year, 3-year process of making that film. It was very, very long. And so I was still doing freelance during that time. There was a little bit of back and forth between doing the freelance work and then pausing for a week to work on this film. And then we released it and it blew all of our expectations away. And so that was amazing. And also on top of that, I was able to actually, we made a profit. I made the $10,000 back that I put into the film, as well as some runway for me to take a step back and think about what do I want to do with my life. Now that I've, you know, put out my first original film, I don't need to, I probably have, you know, expenses for a year, maybe two. So I don't have to actually work my freelance projects. And that was when I started thinking about, okay, what do I want to do next? Where do I want to invest my time? And do I want to go all in with original content creation?
That opens up so many doors and I want to go down. I actually rewatched the documentary last night with my girlfriend Mallory. And I was trying to put myself back in the shoes of 2014 through 2016 when you guys are filming this. Because you're interviewing guys like Sam Harris, who I imagine would be very difficult to get a hold of now. I didn't realize this is your first original piece of content. So, you know, I was telling you before we started recording, I respect you as someone that has high intentionality for how he spends his time. For you to say, I am still in debt, but I want to embark on a year plus of creating this documentary with these guys. How did you decide that that was the opportunity that you wanted to take a risk on and really invest that kind of time into with the obligations and constraints that you already had in front of you?
Yeah, well, this is going to sound really corny, but 3 months before we made this film, I've made a bucket list. And at the top of the bucket list, I said, make a documentary about something I care about. And minimalism was something that had impacted and changed my life. Back in 2010, when I graduated college, like I said, I had about $100,000 in student debt. I was living in my parents' basement. My filmmaking career wasn't going really well. And I still felt like I needed to prove to everyone else and to myself that I was successful. I needed to have all these symbols of success, like the house, the cars, the tech gadgets, and all that. And it was finding minimalism that helped me to question all those assumptions. And it helped me to really think about the direction that I wanted to head. And so I think that was really the precipice for wanting to make a film about it because it impacted and changed my life. And then, you know, it was crazy. Like 3 months after I made that bucket list, I got an email from Josh, who ran The Minimalists, and he was like, hey, we're about to go on tour, you know, it's for our new book, and we really want to, you know, do a tour documentary. And then I was like, oh, that's, you know, that's interesting. Like, I don't want to do a tour documentary. Like, I love you guys. Like, you know, they eventually became great friends, but a tour documentary to me is not very compelling. Like, I was thinking a little bit bigger, and I was like, what if we you know, dive into the movement? And like being a fan of all those blogs, you know, Sam Harris was obviously a great catch. And it was like, it wasn't something that was easy to get. And I still, even at the time, like he's big now, he was big back then. And like at the time I was like, oh, I don't, like getting Sam Harris would be really difficult. But Josh is like really, really good. He spent, you know, years and years in the corporate world. And so he's like very good at email language and pulling people in and winning people over. And so he did a great job of landing a lot of the interviews for the film. But, you know, for me, I think, you know, obviously love Sam Harris, but some of the people I was most excited about were people like Leo Babauta. Again, he ran a website called zenhabits.net. It was a blog that was really inspiring and influential to me. There was Joshua Becker, Courtney Carver, all these other people who had lived this minimalist lifestyle. And so, yeah, that was definitely one of the most exciting things to me. But yeah, we certainly didn't know where it was going to go from the moment we started.
Were you prepping the questions and conducting the interviews as you were shooting them?
I think it was a bit of back and forth. So Josh Milburn was, he was one of our co-producers and he was one of the, you know, the main guys in the film. He conducted most of the interviews when we were together. It was a process of 3 years. And so we did a lot of those interviews on the road when we went on tour with them for their book tour. This ended up being the through line of the film. It was like the story of Josh and Ryan and how they went from suit and tie corporate guys to minimalists. And now they're just talking about and spreading this message and like watching this movement and the message grow. Josh did a lot of the interviews while we were there, although we both kind of collaborated on questions that we would ask. And then, you know, when it comes to an interview where it's going to be cut down, you kind of are thinking in your head, what are the elements that you want to get? What are the responses you're going to get? Much similar to a podcast. Although if it's a long form of conversation, that's very different than saying, okay, well, we want to actually be able to pull something out of this and you're not going to hear my voice. And so there's certain questions you need to ask and framing and reframing and asking the same question twice in a different way, because maybe that first response didn't really give you exactly what you needed to edit into the film. And so you have to think about all those things. That's why it's great to have somebody else asking the questions, like Josh or a producer or whoever. That way I can sit back, and especially since it was me filming everything. You know, a lot of times if you have a bigger shoot, you have a DP and all these other people helping out. But since I was filming everything, I wanted to be able to sit back, digest it, watch it from a third person perspective versus being in that one-on-one conversation. Sometimes that's at least for me, I know my skills are better in contemplating, thinking, sitting back, and then responding once I've taken the time to think about it, as opposed to being off the cuff, responding and having this dynamic conversation with this person and leading it where you want it to go. And so a lot of times after Josh would finish, you know, a 45-minute interview, I might interject in the middle every once in a while if I see somewhere where it could go. But usually at the end, I would kind of take over that conversation and add a few more questions.
So after this reached the success that it did, and you're credited with being the director, you're on the first, you know, page of Netflix when you look at the documentary, and you have this runway you're talking about, and you're saying, what do I want to do next? How did you think through that and not just go down the line of another documentary or another feature film? You know, what was that process like?
That's a great question. I understood then what it meant to have self-reliance today, like in the digital age. And I knew that a large, large part of the success of the film, obviously amazing filmmaking, right? But then on top of that it was the fact that Josh and Ryan had this audience. And you couldn't look past the fact that they had an audience that were excited and willing to pay to view their content. And I knew that there were other films I wanted to make outside of minimalism. And I didn't want to be reliant on anybody else's audience to be able to make a living and to tell the stories that I wanted to tell. And so that's where I started to think, okay, I know that I need to build an audience. It seemed like the most impossible thing to do in the world. Like truly, I was like, you know, it just seems so unrealistic. But every time I had done that in the past, every time I had pushed against my doubt and I had tried something that I thought was impossible, like getting out of debt, starting a freelance film career, making a documentary, it worked out because I put myself into it fully. And I said, all right, I'm just going to do that with this project of building and starting an audience. And also, like, I had just gotten so much great advice personally and also through reading blogs and books. And I read everything you could on entrepreneurship and building and growing an audience. And I'm like, I know all the things. I need to actually put it into action now and just give myself 2 to 3 years and say, okay, I'm just going to dedicate myself for this period of time, no matter what, through the face of failure, doubt, and all the other like negative things that happened during those early periods of time, and just push through and kind of just look towards that finish line as opposed to looking at those short-term failures.
When we come back, Matt talks about how he began building his own audience on YouTube right after this.
If you know me, you know how much I believe in memberships. My membership is the core of my business, and earning an income directly from your audience is one of the most sustainable ways for you to become a professional creator too. So I want to tell you about today's sponsor, Uscreen. Uscreen is a beautiful all-in-one platform that helps content creators earn a living from their videos by unlocking predictable, recurring revenue. You can host private live streams for your members, build an on-demand catalog of premium content, and Uscreen gives you a community hub to interact with your members too. They can access your community from their mobile phone, so your membership is right there in their pocket. With a Uscreen account, you get video hosting, an out-of-the-box website, full payment and subscription management, and plenty of third-party integrations too. And Uscreen makes it easy to get set up. You get access to powerful website themes that are fully brandable with no coding skills required. Uscreen will even provide a dedicated success manager for you. Just about anyone that wants to make money from their content can do it with Uscreen. It's perfect for coaches, authors, influencers, and entrepreneurs in just about any niche. Right now, Uscreen is used by creators in fitness, education, news, kids entertainment, and more. That includes Yoga with Adrian and Creator Now, just to name a couple. Uscreen is the platform for building a video membership site that is great for generating a sustainable income for professional creators. If you create video content for your audience, I highly recommend checking it out. If you're interested in learning more about Uscreen, visit uscreen.link/J. That's uscreen.link/J, and let them know that I sent you. If you work with clients and you want to grow your top line revenue without growing a big payroll at the same time, then consider attending the Solopreneur Summit, a VIP event hosted by my friend Ken Yarmish. Ken has personally closed over $50 million in his career as a solopreneur, all in professional services. I've learned a lot from Ken, and he's worked with some of the biggest names today. People like Matt Barker, Nosheen Chen, Laura Acosta, and Jake Ward trust Ken to get clearer offers and scale their business with systems.
Now, Ken is running a two-day in-person summit on May 9th and 10th to help you build systems across marketing, sales, and client delivery. So now you too can grow without hiring. This will be a workshop setting. It's the anti-loud, obnoxious conference with no more than 50 people who will go deep with Ken and other experts that he's brought in to solve actual problems in your business. Ken and his invited experts will show you their proven systems across personal branding, driving inbound leads, social selling, crafting scalable offers, using AI to automate client delivery, and more. Stop guessing and start learning from those who are 3 to 5 steps ahead of you. Get actionable tactics and proven systems to accelerate your pipeline, close more deals, and get out of client delivery hell. Head to trs.club/summit to learn more and register for the Solopreneur Summit today. At that website, you'll see some of the other experts that are coming in that will allow you to go behind the scenes and look at their actual businesses. Again, that URL is trs.club/summit. One last time, that's trs.club/summit.
Welcome back to my conversation with Matt Diavella. After the massive success of minimalism, Matt took the opportunity to step back and think about what he wanted to do next. And in looking at the success of the film, he realized that a lot of credit went to the fact that the minimalists had already been building their own audience. So Matt decided that he was going to start building his own audience, and he started by putting his filmmaking skills to use on YouTube.
There was certainly a lot of experimentation in the beginning, and I tried, vlog format, just simple talking head. I tried riffing to the camera, which turned out wasn't the best approach for me. I definitely found that I was much better when I planned and scripted and wrote out my videos and really thought about the story I wanted to tell, the humor that I wanted to add into it. I definitely think that there's two style of creators today. There's the freestylers and those that write, kind of like hip hop, where somebody can freestyle something amazing off the top of their head. That's not me. If I got up on stage, I piss my pants. So I'm the guy that's like reading from a poem on stage. And so you kind of like have this ego, I think, in the beginning too, that like you watch a Gary Vee video and you're like, oh, I can do that. And then you just try to like, you turn on the camera, start riffing, and you're like, I'm an idiot. And so that was, I learned through that experience and I adapted my approach. And I think after maybe 10 videos or so messing around on YouTube, obviously not seeing any kind of results, I kind of leaned into podcasting. That's when I started the Ground Up show. Again, it was like telling stories in the beginning, realizing that wasn't working, then going into the interview format and starting by chatting with friends. And I had a plan of growing the YouTube channel of being like, okay, obviously the way to grow this thing is to get big guests on the show. So then they share it with their audience. I knew leaning into high quality video, which at the time really wasn't done that much. I mean, at the time, people that were doing video podcasts, it was Joe Rogan, and his video was just awful. And, obviously amazing podcast, but like the production quality of the video just wasn't good. And I think Lewis Howes was doing it, but he had like those headsets and it was like, it just seemed like distracting. I'm like, why are you doing that?
It's so interesting how when people started doing video podcasts, they regressed on what they thought good video was. They're like, well, because it's a podcast, we need to make it clear visually that it's a podcast.
Exactly. Such a strange thing. And like, I think when you're doing a podcast and it's in that format, you have some creative liberties. Like obviously you can put a microphone like the ones we're using now in front of your face and it looks fine because people are like, oh, it's a podcast and you get it. But still like I wouldn't do something that didn't look good. I wouldn't do something that looked like I was, an insurance salesperson. To Lewis Howes' credit, he switched and now he does wireless microphones. But I think at the time, like a lot of people didn't really think about it that way. And so I saw an opportunity. I was like, oh, I can lean into this high quality, lean into the visuals. One that just creates some validation. People see that and they, this must be high quality. He's invested time and energy into this production. So I'll invest some time and energy into listening to the episode. And then on top of that was, if I created these little excerpts, these takeaways that were cut and carved from that main episode. Like this is so obvious now and so many people do it, but it's like, it was taking these short videos, 30 seconds, a minute long. And then after I did the episode with somebody who maybe had a much larger following than me, maybe 10,000 followers on Instagram, I could then share like 5 different clips with them, making them look as brilliant as possible. Like never pressuring them, saying, hey, if you want to share this, would absolutely love it. If not, that's totally cool. You being on the show was good enough, was, obviously worth the time. And I obviously appreciate you doing that. And so that was like my growth strategy. And it was like, interview friends to begin with, create a teaser for this thing so then I can sell it to other experts and people who have a bigger following than me. And then hopefully eventually a few of those people will share it and then I'll be able to grow. And that's exactly what happened. I mean, Rich Roll, ultra endurance athlete, podcaster, he has a huge following, and he was just gracious enough to come on my podcast at I think around 30 episodes in. And he, I think in part, and this is the same thing when I do, whenever I, come on a podcast like this or anybody else's podcast, it's not about the audience size as much as it is about respecting the person and the platform and what they've created. And like, you obviously put a ton of time into building a beautiful website and setting this whole thing up. And so I think that's really what I look at, is like, has the time been invested? And I think that's what Rich Roll saw. So I, shared some clips with him. He shared it on his Instagram. That was the biggest spike. I went from like 1,000 downloads a month to 8,000 downloads a month. And it's that snowball, that momentum that can start building. And I did see it from the beginning, but it certainly took a lot of experimentation and playing around to find my place.
As Matt was experimenting with the video podcast format on YouTube, he was managing a lot of creative output. For any given video, there's the scripting, the shooting, the editing, creating a title, making a thumbnail, not to mention putting the podcast up on audio players, writing a newsletter, running his own social media channels. It's just a lot. So I asked Matt how he was able to manage his time and creative energy while maintaining such a high level of creative output.
I'm very good at batching. And so, it took a little while to learn this lesson, but I think when I hit my rhythm, it was kind of paying attention to where my energy goes and where my energy gets drained the most. And conducting interviews certainly drains my energy like nothing else, because you have to plan this interview and then there's pressure and stress on you to get the interview right. You know this. I don't think a lot of people realize what actually goes into it, but like, especially when you care about something, there's obviously people who don't care about the work and then they're just like, it's a conversation, whatever. And I don't think that those people, unless they're an amazing freestyler, like unless they're like, they have maybe a celebrity advantage or whatever, I think that like, you really have to put in the work if you want to get really good at something, and you have to actually prepare. And like the actual interview itself, and like, obviously you battle with like self-consciousness and like overthinking yourself. And when somebody else is answering a question, you're like, this is getting very meta, but like, then like you're thinking about like, what should I say next? And like, it really drains me. So I would try to batch like 2 to 4 interviews over a couple of days. And then I would go through in Final Cut and edit like the entire episodes, like back to back, like 4 episodes in a row, because there is, especially with a podcast, an element of like structure. Like you create the intro, you record the intro. So I could record 4 intros at once, 4 outros at once. I had copy and pasting effects and all this stuff over from one to the other. Like, dude, I really, I'm starting to work on courses and stuff. And I think I really want to get into more creative style courses and teaching filmmaking, because I think the huge advantage I had, I'll tell you the 2 most important skills that I've personally learned that I've put into is like video editing and writing. And so like with the video editing, it was really just putting 10, 15 years into like editing and Final Cut and putting in the time. And I like learned shortcuts. I learned how to edit quickly. And like I could get to a point where I could, just by looking at the waveforms and like splitting the edit in a certain way, I could edit a 1-hour podcast in about 15 minutes. Incredible. And yeah. And like, but that's also like, it's like using shortcuts and like seeing the waveforms. I see that I'm talking, he's talking, I'm talking, she's talking. And then this part, we're both talking at the same time. So I'll go to the wide angle shot and I could just fly through a full edit in 15 minutes. Obviously then I would want to do another pass, like being the perfectionist I am and making myself sound smart and getting rid of like some ums and ahs and false starts where you start asking a question and then you eventually rephrase the question down the road, and I would just clean those things up. But I think it was putting all that time into editing that I had gotten skilled enough where I could do it much quicker than I would have 10 years earlier. And so I think that is kind of just batching and then investing my time into my skills was really how I was able to produce as much content as I was, especially during those early days.
Matt's podcast, The Ground Up Show, was beginning to build a strong following on YouTube and on the audio platforms too. And even though it was growing with an assist from guests like Rich Roll, Matt was still experimenting with other ways to grow on the platform.
In the beginning, I experimented a lot. And then I was like, all right, it's going to be the podcast. That's what I'm doing. And then I just poured everything into that. And this is what I think is great about YouTube in general, is that it's so easy to look back at creators and see how they got successful. Like, if you want to be a great YouTuber now and you want to build a sustainable YouTube channel, go back and look at some of your favorite YouTubers, look how they started, see the first video that took off for them, you know, see how that video was crafted, the title, the thumbnail, all those things. Like, we can look back at all these people. And I love doing that for people like Joe Rogan.
Dead air bad, Rogan. Where's Goldie? Yeah, we just started this. It's not very good. I apologize.
It's that person, probably.
No, it's not. See, it's this guy right here. More red. See? Good sound quality.
Yeah, the video. Oh.
See? Different guy. This guy's tweeted. His tweet's not coming through.
Oh, that might be, yeah. That might be something weird. I was talking about the where they said the sound and video.
Snowflakes falling are a bit annoying. Oh, come on. It's Christmas. Video and sound are okay, but the snowflakes are annoying. Does everybody feel like the snowflakes are annoying? Is it just one dude that's kind of, you know, anal about what he looks at on a screen? Come on, man. It's beautiful snowflakes.
Like, that gives you so much inspiration. Like, he started out just live streaming. There was animations in front of the screen. Like, if you looked at it, you'd be like, there's no way this guy is going to be the biggest podcaster in the world. And so it starts from, again, sloppy beginnings. And so, you know, for me, it was, I got into this groove, which can be a good thing, but I wasn't seeing results. Like, I saw that result from the Rich Roll episode, but then again, it plateaued. And I was seeing some growth, but not enough growth that I could make a full-time living from it. And so it took me about another year to really start to experiment more and really step outside the box of the podcast. And it was about a year to a year and a half after I initially started this whole thing. It was March 2018. I, you know, saw people making videos about minimalist apartments. And I was like, on YouTube, and they had a lot of views. And I was like, put two and two together. I'm like,
I could do that.
Yeah, I could do that. Like, I'm a minimalist. I have an apartment and I'm a filmmaker. What I was so hesitant to do originally was to invest my time and energy. Because a video like that, when I'm really, really trying hard, will take about a week. That's a lot of time when I'm writing the video and then I'm planning out the shots and then I'm shooting the video and then I'm editing it. Even if it's a 3-minute video, it just takes a lot of time. And when you don't have an audience, you're kind of hesitant to want to put in that time because
it's a big investment.
Yeah, it's a huge investment. You put it up there and then the most likely scenario is that nobody watches it. And so obviously that could be crushing if you really invest the time and energy into it. But it was a lesson once, you know, I got through that like, that's actually what you have to do. You have to put in that kind of hard work. And it's what I did with the podcast. I just didn't really think about it from the perspective of the YouTube channel. So I made a video called My Minimalist Apartment, and it was really cinematic. It was color graded nicely. I added some humor and personality into it. I really tried to finesse the editing the best I could. And then I uploaded it. And I think within a couple, like maybe a week, it got like 20,000 views, which was like more than any video I'd ever uploaded. And then it just kept going and going and going. And I remember like our mutual friend, Jason Zook, he was like messaging me and be like, dude, I've never seen anything like this. Like, what the heck's going on? Like, oh, huge wake up call. I should edit like short, well thought out YouTube videos and like about minimalism. And then maybe later on about self-development and about the things that I've learned. And that was really what shifted. It was that response that made me realize, oh, okay, this is where I need to focus my time and energy on and not so much on the podcast.
The experimentation you're talking about here is like structural in the format of the show itself. And experimentation, I'm sure, has taken a ton of different forms for you, even down to like the headlines and the style of the thumbnail. So if I'm pretty early on creating content, how should I think about experimentation and how to approach that in a way that I can get real useful insights versus endlessly chasing the next shiny object?
I think it comes with self-awareness and it comes with being able to objectively look at your work and understanding like what's the best direction to head. And like, you know, you have to look at feedback. I think a lot of people are really resistant to look at feedback. They think that every comment is a troll, every negative piece of feedback is a troll and it's not actual legitimate criticism. It's not easy. And like I know firsthand that you could look at 100 good comments, positive comments, and then one negative comment, and that one negative one just sticks with you for like a week. It's just that deep sinking pain in your stomach. being open-minded, being thoughtful about how you take in that feedback and understanding that not all of it is on a level playing field. Like what my mom thinks of my videos, like it's amazing that she loves my videos, but you know, it might not change my perspective in terms of what I'm going to do. But if I see an overwhelming amount of people say like, oh man, like in Matt's podcast, like he really talks a lot in his videos. Like he just needs to let his guests speak. Then I'll be like, okay, let me think about that. Is that true? Am I speaking too much? Am I talking about myself? Why am I talking about myself? And like in those instances, I'm like, well, like a lot of times I'm trying to make this feel as conversational as possible. And by me opening up, they open up. But I also understand that might not come across that way to a listener. And so like being open-minded, understanding, and then again, like using the experimentation, tweaking, maybe trying a few episodes where like, okay, I'm going to try to be the best damn listener in the world on this episode, you know, and to your point, it goes along with creating thumbnails, titles, everything, like seeing what other people are doing, see what's working for other people, and then doing what feels right for you. Because I think a lot of times it's not just about maximizing your reach. And, you know, when I think about YouTube videos, there's so much that you could do to maximize your reach on a YouTube video in terms of creating it more sensational, more edgy, more viral. Like you could definitely tweak these things, but then you start to lose trust in your audience. And even if you do get more views in that video, I don't think it's worth it. And so there have been like instances where I've harped over a single word in a title for like days where I'm like, should I do that one? Should I do this one? And you kind of always do, at least on YouTube, you often come to this line where you're like, is this clickbait or not? I've had a couple videos that were, I wouldn't say, well, okay, questionable, because I certainly questioned them when I was making them, you know what I mean? But then I realized, I was like, okay, I think it's actually clever. Like one is like, this productivity system will save your life was the name of the video. It sounds crazy sensational. But the video was about checklists and how airline pilots and doctors use them to save lives. And so again, at first glance, it looks sensational. And certainly a lot of people think that it is, but I think that it actually returns on the message. It returns on the promise that I made in the title. And I think as long as you're fulfilling that promise, you can kind of play with the lines. But again, you have to live with it. You have to feel good about yourself. And if you keep doing it and you keep pushing that line too far, you may not feel good about yourself and your audience may start to lose trust in you.
After the break, Matt dives deeper into his video making process today, what he's learned about crafting a good story, and how he protects himself from burnout. So stick around because we'll be right back.
Let me tell you about one of my favorite podcasts that I've been listening to for years. It's called The $100 MBA Show. And wherever you are on your business journey, The $100 MBA Show has lessons that can help you take the next step forward. The $100 MBA Show is a Best of Apple Podcasts winner, literally one of the top Apple podcasts of all time. And it's hosted by my friend and former guest, Omar Zenholm. Omar is a business school dropout turned successful entrepreneur, and he shares real-world lessons on starting, growing, and scaling your business. You may even know his software product, Webinar Ninja. What I love about the $100 MBA show is that these are well-produced, bite-sized episodes on everything from creating a product, connecting with your market, sales, building a team, and more. This show is legit. It does over 2 million downloads every month. Whether you're a small-time solopreneur or scaling your startup to investor level, there's valuable real-world advice for you in the $100 MBA's archive of thousands of episodes, with new episodes 3 days a week. If that sounds interesting to you, and it should, just search for $100 MBA Show wherever you get your podcasts. This episode is sponsored by Podcast Movement. For the past decade, Podcast Movement has organized the world's largest gathering of podcasters, featuring thousands of attendees, hundreds of breakout sessions, panels, and workshops, plus the largest trade show in podcasting. Podcast Movement helps podcasters of all experience levels create, grow, and profit from their show. It's suitable for beginners, but you'll also have the opportunity to meet some of the biggest names in the industry. I've been to several Podcast Movement events, and not only is the programming incredible, but the culture and vibe are incredible too. It attracts thoughtful, empathetic, and collaborative people, which makes sense when you think about the medium of podcasting. Podcast Movement hosts 2 events per year. The first just wrapped up, but their flagship conference is happening August 19th through the 22nd in Washington, D.C. Attendees have the freedom to choose their own adventure across several different stages throughout the 4-day event, not to mention dozens of amazing networking events, parties, and the expo hall floor.
Tracks include podcast creation, video and live streaming, industry professional, plus several stages of curated programming from some of the top companies in podcasting. It's truly a unique event, and if you are a podcaster, I cannot recommend it enough. Right now, tickets are available at super duper early bird pricing. And as a Creator Science listener, you can save $50 on top of that by visiting podcastmovement.com/science. That's podcastmovement.com/science. Welcome back to Creative Elements. When I think about creators like Matt, who have literally millions of followers, it's hard for me to even fathom. In episode 10 of the show, Amy Landino talked about creating all of her videos for her made-up avatar, Charlotte. And since then, I've been thinking a lot about my audience and what I know or think I know about those of you listening. So I was curious how Matt thought about his own audience. At what point did you feel like you really had a handle on who your audience was? And when did that start to drive the type of content you were creating?
I don't think I do have a clear... No, I have a pretty good...
I didn't know.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I mean, honestly, like, I think that's like certainly a big takeaway is that like, I still have tons and tons of doubt. And I don't, you know, I've talked about this with Jason Zook a lot, where it's like, there is, to me, at least in my own experience, there has been no feeling change from 15,000 subscribers, the number that I thought was going to be like the end all be all, to 300,000 to 3 million. Like, it really, like, inside, I don't feel like a different person at all. I, you know, still put the same amount of energy and effort into my videos. I think I just focus on making the best videos I possibly can. I kind of internalize the feedback, the response, and I have to take that in like everything else. Like, my wife is super supportive and she watches so many of my videos, and I'm often like asking her for advice, what she thinks. Did I go too far with this? Is this joke appropriate or not? Am I going to get in trouble for saying this? And then she'll give me her opinion, and then I take that in. And I'm like, okay, should I do that? Or should I actually, you know, push it on this one? Or should I scale this back? And so I think like my understanding of my audience continues to evolve and change. But at the end of the day, it's like, I have to continue to make the best videos that I can, trying to add the most value as possible. I think a big lesson for me was leaning into experimentation versus being an expert. And that was tough for me in the beginning, because I think the misconception is that if you're talking about something on YouTube, you need to be an expert. And so I wanted to come from a place of like, hey guys, I'm just like you. Like, I'm going through this stuff. I struggle with procrastination and habits and everything else. And this is what I'm working on. This is what I'm learning about, or this is what I've learned in the past about this. And I think that perspective, one, it opened me up to a whole bunch of other content. And two, it allowed me to just like, just be myself as opposed to pretending to be somebody I wasn't.
I want to return to this topic I had of doing really, really good work. You've mentioned a couple times just the amount of time that goes into even writing for some of these videos. I think a lot of people will look at mediums that aren't explicitly written mediums and think that there's not a ton of writing involved. So I'd love to hear a little bit more about when you decide you have enough reason to do a certain video versus not, because I'm sure you have some multiple of ideas versus how many things you actually end up making a video about. So how do you know that there's enough thought and intention behind an idea before making an actual video about it?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think first, is the idea something that interests me? Is it something that I could sit down and write about for a couple hours and I would have plenty to say about it? And I think that's like the first thing. Does it interest me? You know, I don't know if I would say that I'm deeply, deeply passionate about procrastination or habits. I am deeply passionate about filmmaking and storytelling and, you know, telling those stories. And so I think like it's combining my passion with my interests. And so finding things that I would be interested in talking about and exploring and learning more about. And I think that is like the very baseline. I used to think that it was bad to think about the title before you made the video. I don't know why. I just think like maybe like it was an integrity thing. It's like, well, I'm not gonna.
Something isn't pure.
It's, yeah, exactly. Like not pure art. But then, especially as my audience started to grow, I was like, if I can't think of at least a somewhat compelling title, almost like an elevator pitch, like how could I tell this idea in one sentence? In I forget how many characters, like it's like 45 characters or whatever. There's a 100 character limit before it starts to get cut off on YouTube. I like to keep most of my videos within about 45 characters in terms of the title. And so that just kind of like keeps it on two lines. It's like, what is the substance? What's the message that you're trying to get across? Why would somebody click on this video? And so I think that becomes important when you're trying to serve an audience and when also you're trying to create a sustainable, thriving community. You know, if you didn't do a good job of that, then, you know, less and less people would show up to your videos. You'd be able to help less and less people. And so I do think about, does a topic interest me? Then is there a compelling title there that I can work together? And I try to just find one to start and that's enough. And I'm like, okay, great. Like if all else fails, I go with that one. But then usually as the process of writing goes along, I might come up with new ideas for that title. Or what often happens is at the end, once I'm finished writing the video, I will workshop 10, 20 different titles. I will just, you know, on that same document where I'm writing out my video, I will try every single title and variation. Even if I know it sounds like shit, I'm like, okay, well, okay, what if I word it like that? What if I word it like that? What if I swap this word out? And just getting a vibe for what feels right. There's actually a great website called thumbsup.tv. Thumbsup.tv, you can just go there and it allows you to drag and drop your thumbnail and put your title in and it shows you how it will show up on every YouTube UI. Hmm. So from Apple TV to your desktop to the sidebar or the homepage on YouTube. And I found that to be pretty helpful when I'm stuck and when I'm like, I just want to see what this would look like on YouTube's platform. Because again, this is like the marketing side of things. I think there's the content and then there's the marketing. And I think you should put 80 to 90% of your time working on the content and making the best film you possibly can on YouTube specifically. And then 20% of your time working on the title, thumbnail, and all that stuff. And like that's really how you're going to improve your reach.
What's the lead time on a video for you? You know, you're talking about all these different steps. Are you working on this week's video, you know, right now? Or right now are you working on a video that's going to release 4 weeks from now?
So that's changed over the years. Like, I mean, I've been in a spot before where I have 5 videos done. And that is a glorious feeling. Like, honestly, that's where I want to be right now in my life. Because it's just like the stress and the anxiety start to like decrease and I see like, just like you want a financial runway when you're starting anything creative, having, you know, the next 4 videos or 4 episodes done and in the can helps to like create without fear. Cause there's always that fear that you're going to run out of an idea or the next video you make out is going to be terrible and people are going to stop watching it.
Or you burn yourself out doing 4 videos in a row and then just take 4 weeks off and you're right back in the same spot.
Yeah. Oh my God. I've totally done that where I've, you know, that happened last year where my wife and I took a long trip. We were going to a wedding and then spending time in Italy and RIP travel. And there was like 4 weeks, I think, that we took off. And so I had videos planned for all those 4 weeks. And then I got back and then I didn't have any video planned for when I got back. And then it's like all that break and the relief of being on break, it was kind of a little bit corrupted by the fact that I was anxious knowing when I got back, I would be like back in the same boat and starting over from scratch. I think this is like one of the endless battles of a creative and knowing when to just like allow yourself a break and to not put out a video this week and take a couple weeks off to get back on your feet. So ideal world, I would have a few weeks out, 2 to 4 weeks. I think in these times with the pandemic and everything going on, I realized that I actually wanted to create week to week. I actually pushed a couple of videos I was going to upload a little bit later because it didn't feel like the right time. And I was like, I actually need to respond to the moment of what's happening right now. And so creating week to week was actually helpful. In most cases, I think it's great to have some runway there. I think from right now where I'm at is it's Wednesday and my video for next week, I have it written, but I haven't filmed it or edited it yet. So I'll do that by the end of the week and then I'll have my Tuesday video done. I'm working on a couple other big side projects that including a feature film. So, you know, it's tough to juggle all these things. And so letting the runway go is one of the things that I had to do.
With such a large channel, there's super wide variance video to video of how one performs. So how do you look at the performance of your channel over a period of time to know if, like, how would you know if your quality was starting to slip or you were just starting to not hit the message that your audience has come to expect?
I think that question hits on a fear that almost every YouTuber has. And it's something I've talked with many, many other YouTubers who have just as large or larger audiences. I don't think that fear goes away completely. You always have this kind of like in the back of your head being like, this could be it. Like this is, we talk about it all the time. Like this video could be the one where everything starts going downhill and then all my audience abandons me and leaves me. And that might be true. Like that might happen. And I think preparing for worst case scenario isn't such a bad thing. I think that at the end of the day, like you'd have to do something really dumb to really lose your entire audience. And for me, it was, again, going back to that 15,000 number, it was about being happy with what you already have and knowing that, I mean, like obviously for me, like 3 million, like I don't need a fraction of that to actually do what I love to do, which is make films every day. And I always think about worst case scenario. I'm like, all right, you know what? If YouTube exploded tomorrow and I lost everything, I would just start making videos for freelance again because I love making films. And I'm sure maybe there's another influencer, somebody else that I can partner up with to make a film. And so that gives me comfort and lets me to relax when the numbers aren't consistent and when there's highs and lows, when you put out one video that has like half as many views as what you're used to seeing. And then one video goes viral and it's like being able to deal with those swings, I think really important. And then just being able to also understand that, you know, nothing lasts forever. And am I going to be 60 years old making YouTube videos about procrastination? Like, I don't know, maybe, but I imagine there's going to be many iterations and I'm going to continue to evolve and make new things and pursue new projects. And so just kind of having that self-awareness and understanding about what the future might bring certainly helps with the ups and downs.
Between directing Minimalism, more than 100 episodes of his podcast, The Ground Up Show, and the highly produced videos on his YouTube channel, I knew Matt has learned a thing or two about good storytelling. So I asked him what lessons he's learned for crafting a good story.
One big lesson comes back to freestyle versus writing. And I think that even people who are great freestyling off the top of their head, I think everybody will be able to tell a better story if they take a step back, they plan it, they write out as much as they can. Now, your writing process might look different than mine. You may not write the entire thing all the way through, or you might just write bullet points about where you want it to go. Because I'm always thinking about, how do I make this story engaging and compelling and keeping people interested throughout? There was this amazing breakdown somebody did of like the kind of how my videos are structured in terms of like A roll, B roll, when you see me on camera, when you don't see me on camera, what are the different elements that I use to keep people engaged? Which was kind of like, as much as like I live and breathe it every day, it was interesting to see somebody else break that down for me to take a step back and be like, oh, that's interesting that they noticed those things. But it's like, you won't see me on camera typically for more than 30 seconds, especially early on in the video. There's obviously exceptions to that rule, but my pacing is rather quick. Even though a lot of people will say like, wow, like your videos are so calming and slow. But still, that's because I think I don't do like wacky transitions and sound effects. And like, you know, like a lot of times on YouTube, there is a certain style that is pretty prevalent. But I like to think about, okay, the opener, how do I make it really interesting and compelling? How do I hit on, again, like I know this is very YouTube specific as well. So hopefully people can translate it to other platforms. But how do I make it kind of follow through with the expectation of what they thought they were going to click on? They thought they were going to click on a certain kind of content. And so I want to like reassure them, hey, that is exactly what you clicked on. Like you're going to learn about this. The worst thing is clicking on something. Again, this is where clickbait comes in, where it doesn't fulfill that promise. And so letting the viewer know early on, figuring out a creative way to hook them, and then thinking about pacing throughout, knowing when to play a music track, when to let the music speak for itself and to dominate the film, when to let it just sit in the background and have it so you don't even notice it, when to cut it completely and live in silence. That's something I think a skill a lot of people don't really take advantage of, where they think they have to score every single second of their video. I think letting that moment of silence speak for itself can add some drama, some interest, and actually pull a viewer in a way that music can't do. And then I think, adding like sketches and humor, it's something that I love to do. And it's something that actually brings me a lot of joy in the videos that I make, where sometimes the most fun is like my wife and I shooting a sketch back and forth and just bantering and riffing and having fun. And then when I add that to the video, that comes through. And I think people enjoy those little breaks in the momentum. And so not trying to take yourself too seriously. I think that it takes a lot of time and energy and like years and years to really develop as a storyteller, but you find it oftentimes in the edit. So as much as I write and plan my videos, things change when I'm shooting it. especially like there's like impromptu moments and like times where I riff just because like I think that might create like a natural funny element. There are certain things that can't be scripted, obviously. And then beyond that, it's just, you know, realizing that once I get into the editing, once I'm sitting down, I realize, oh, that sounds corny. Oh my God. Like, I can't believe I wrote that. Like, why would I say that in a video? And then I'm changing it and I'm recording new voiceover because I think it fits better for the video and I'm restructuring it. And what I thought was going to be the opener actually ended up being in the middle of the video. And then I changed what the opener was going to be, or I had to reshoot some footage. And so perfectionist tendencies in there for sure. But I think really it's about trying to get it right and trying to make the most interesting, compelling story out of what you have and also what you can create. So you kind of have to open yourself up to not being held to, this is the way I wrote it, this is the way I originally planned it, so that's the way it needs to be. Adapting and changing and kind of going with your gut. And I think honing that intuition is really what's going to help you tell great stories.
One last question, and you can make this as brief as you want. I really respect the very apparent boundaries and balance that you have with technology, despite being deeply ingrained in technology for like your life force, you know, or like what you're sustaining income. What types of systems do you have in place now that you would recommend even somebody getting started out who doesn't have nearly the amount of inbound, I'm sure you do, create enough balance and boundaries for themselves to maintain some creative space?
Yeah, I think boundaries is really a key word there. And I just did a video on this recently where I talked about like just the three ways to add boundaries into your life. And you could add boundaries into your day, your weeks, and on a monthly or bi-monthly basis. For me, rules have been just absolutely essential. Maybe it's the way I think, but I know certainly a lot of other people resonate with creating rules, which really are boundaries, to make sure that you don't do that thing that you know that you shouldn't. And we're all guilty of this. And as much as I try to set boundaries, I also break them. You might set rules like no screens in bed, no screens 2 hours before bed. I'm going to stop working at 6 p.m. every day. I'm going to set a certain time when I start working each day, especially now that most of us are working from home. I think those rules can be even more important because we're not coming home from the office or from the co-working space to come home. On a weekly basis, you know, it's respecting weekends. That's something that's, as a creative, as people who are super ambitious and fired up about what they're doing, we'll work weekends. Like, we'll work like 20 weekends in a row, like as we rush towards a project. We'll just finish up this one podcast here. We'll just like write this newsletter in the morning or check this email Sunday night. And then it turns into a 7-day work week. I think taking your rest just as seriously as a part of your productivity as anything else is super important. So respecting the weekends, like again, another rule I would have is no work Saturdays. And again, that's giving me, especially when like times are busy, to work the Sunday here and there, to do a little bit of writing on Sunday, but to make sure that we take those days where we don't focus on anything at all. And then I think on the monthly basis is, this is something that I've really started to find much more value in over the past year or so, but it's getting away from the house, especially for me, getting away from the city that I live in and just being out in nature, which I'm so often deprived of, and enjoying the quiet, the solitude, and just completely cutting off all screens, all work, everything, and just doing nothing but, you know, reading books, listening to audiobooks. Obviously, there's a screen there, so I'm a little bit of a hypocrite. But for me, it's like more about consuming interesting content that has nothing to do with entrepreneurship, creativity. It has to do with, oh, let me like listen about history, or let me read a fiction novel. And so those kinds of breaks really allow me to recharge. And also, I think the biggest thing is it gives me perspective. It allows me to realize, am I really focusing on the right things with my work? Am I happy with the amount of work that I'm currently doing? Am I doing this for the right reasons? I find that those kind of breaks, 4 or 5 days away from everything every month or two, have really, really helped and shifted my perspective.
This was such a fun episode to record and edit. Matt's work is such an inspiration to me, and it's easily some of the most well-produced video content on all of YouTube. I really love Matt's perspective that we heard at the very top of this episode. He knew that he had read and learned enough about how to start building his audience. It was just time for him to start putting it into practice. Too often we tell ourselves that we need to learn more or that we aren't ready.
But in reality, it's through trial and error, through experimentation, that we truly learn the most. Matt's focus on experimentation continues to this day. A quick look at his most popular videos will turn up titles like I quit caffeine for 30 days, I counted every calorie for 30 days, I meditated 1 hour every day for 30 days, and I took cold showers for 30 days. I've learned a lot from Matt in this episode, and I really hope that you did too. You can follow Matt on YouTube at youtube.com/MattDiavella or on Instagram at MattDiavella. Links to that will, of course, be in the show notes. Thanks to Matt for being on the show. Thank you to Emily Klaus for making the artwork for this episode. Thanks to Brian Skeel for mixing the show and also creating our music. If you like this episode, jump into our Facebook group by searching Creative Elements Listeners on Facebook. Let me know what you thought, or you can tweet at me at jklaus and let me know. And if you really want to say thank you, please leave a review on Apple Podcasts. I'll keep saying it week after week. Thanks for listening, and I'll talk to you next week.
The Podglomerate, a Sonic Universe.